Well, good morning. Thank you all for joining this morning. And I want to thank you especially for your patience last week as we had a little bit of an audible and invited the children to join us for class. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Quite refreshing to hear their thoughtful answers and to even have they had the boldness to read in front of a room full of adults, which takes a lot when you're in middle school. So I was really impressed with them. As we ended last week, we got up through the Lord's promise to deliver manna in response to the complaining of the people. And remember that he said that it would be a test to them. We sort of summarized the last chapter, or the last section of chapter 16, because we didn't have time. We'd taken some extra time for the children early on. I'd like to turn back to those passages and cover them briefly before we move forward. Before we turn there, let's have a word of prayer and a brief introduction. Father God, we read and find so much of ourselves in the Exodus. We are so quick to enjoy the victory that you have brought us, and then to forget where it came from and begin our quarreling. We pray that you would still our hearts, that we would be able to look into the perfect mirror that is your law, see ourselves rightly, and grow because of it. Learn about ourselves and learn to lean in and on you for our righteousness. In Jesus' name, amen. Brief note, before we turn to Exodus 16, we've come to the end of the narrative section that we're going to be covering this year in Sunday school. It's not the end of Sunday school. You might be thinking we have two more weeks. We're going to do some reflection on where we've come and a little bit of looking forward of where we hope to go or where the Pentateuch continues to go. The hope is to pick this back up in September with the opening of the new Sunday school year. The narrative section that we're in right now, remember, sort of has two starts. We had a little bit of a start in chapter 12. Rabbis will draw the line there and say this is the beginning of legal matter. Chapter 12, we get the Feast of Unleavened Bread and a more detailed explanation of the Passover feast that they would keep it for future generations. So these were laws to the people. We divided it rather than at chapter 12. We sort of divided it at chapter 15 because that's where we find another major poem of the Pentateuch, the Song of Moses. And we've been seeing those sort of as delimiting chapter markers as we go through with our previous poem coming in Genesis chapter 49 in the Song of Jacob. So we've sort of begun this new Sinai narrative. With this week, we're going to complete the portion of the narrative that involves coming to Sinai. We're going to end the end of chapter 18. Israel has come to Horeb, or Sinai, and from that point on, the narrative gets really disrupted, which is why we're not continuing on this year. It's going to take time to understand that disruption. We're going to have narrative up through a few verses into 19, and then a chunk of law. And the narrative, and then a chunk of law. Sometimes the narratives can be as short as two or three verses, followed by as many as eight chapters of law, uninterrupted. And so we're going to take our time to evaluate that and to ask questions like, why? Why have we just gone through 68 chapters of narrative, all of a sudden to interrupt it with legal matter? What's the point? What's Moses trying to tell us? A very appropriate question for us to ask, although a little bit secondary as we approach the text, is what does this mean for me? Is Moses trying to tell his reader, here are the rules for you to obey. These are things you should do to be righteous. Or is Moses trying to tell us something else? By putting and also the reader and us are a little bit different in that, of course, Moses was writing for the Israelites early on in their history while they're in the Sinai wilderness. And we, of course, are not them. So there's a lot of application tasks that we will have next year as we approach. But this year will bring us to the end of the journey into Sinai. And that's where we're going to wind up today. All right. I believe reading A is verses 13 through 21 of chapter 16.
In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, There was on the face of the wilderness a fine, flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer according to the number of persons that each of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more and some less. To 21. Okay. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it over until morning." But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted.
Thank you. So this was Israel's first test. Remember that as they had been journeying into Sinai, they would complain and the Lord would provide. But in each provision, he said, "I have a test for you here." In the waters at Marah, we don't hear really about what that test looks like exactly. He simply says, "I'm going to test you to see if you will obey my commands, my statutes, and my laws." Here, we have a little bit more of a clear test. The Lord said, "Don't save any of it." And of course, we have Israel, as they do, failing, at least part of Israel, failing to pass the test. Notice also that the provision of the Lord in manna is very obviously his own. As they go out to gather it, you can imagine there are some who are so hungry they don't want to spend any time. They just sort of sweep some up off the ground and go back to their tent. And there are others who are maybe more planning ahead and thinking, "I don't know when this is going to happen again." They're going to spend an hour gathering and gathering and gathering, and they get back and they have the same amount. This, of course, will be echoed when our Lord feeds the 5,000. No matter how much they handed out, there was still more left over. The amount didn't seem to change, or rather it did change. It increased as they went along rather than decreasing. And then the next day, as those who saved up, who even though they only gathered a manna each, an omer each of them, some of them decide to ration it out. We need to make this thing stretch as long as possible. And so they eat very little on the first day. They must have woken up early the next day hungry. I know I would have. And what they find is that everything they saved, that they worked so hard for and they sacrificed for, it's rotted. And it's rotted in such a way that the stench of it is apparently apparent to their neighbors. It's clear which tent obeyed the Lord and which tent disobeyed the Lord. And so the test has been passed by some and failed by others. It's easy to look back and poke fun at Israel, to see their shortfalling, having known, as we do, the end from the beginning, and say, "Look at how they didn't trust him." It's a whole different thing to look at your children and say, "Well, the food tomorrow has to come tomorrow. It's not in the cupboard, it's not in the deep freezer, or the regular freezer, or the garage freezer," which I know a lot of us enjoy here. It's very difficult to relate to what it must be like, not living paycheck to paycheck, but rather evening to morning. And so we empathize to some degree for their lack of trust for the Lord, although certainly we would condemn it. They should be trusting the Lord, as should we. The Lord, again, is also going to reach back to this in the Beatitudes, or in the Sermon on the Mount, rather, when he says, "Don't worry about what you're going to eat or what you're going to wear. Remember who I am. I'm the bread from heaven. You're covered. You're good." And yet we, like Israel, are very quick to doubt. especially in the face of something as difficult as hunger. All right, let's look to our second test, verses 22 through 30. Thank you. So this is the first observation of the Sabbath we read on man's part. Of course, we read in the creation account, on the seventh day the Lord rested. But this is the first time it's applied to man, and very little instruction is given. Given that the command to rest on the Sabbath, the reasoning for it is always anchored in creation, it's possible that the Lord had told his people throughout the ages that they were to rest on the seventh day. He didn't write it down for us. He didn't include that in the Pentateuch, but it's possible they were already aware of this. It's also possible, and I think it's slightly more likely, that this is simply all the instruction they were given. The Sabbath wasn't to be a complicated thing for Israel. It was to be rest. You shouldn't need an instruction manual for how to take a vacation, right? If you use an instruction manual to take your vacation, you will likely not find it particularly restful. It's something that you do. It's you relax. You let go of the work. You sit down and you rest. I think that's very likely the nature of the communication that they're getting from the Lord here, is that the Sabbath was intended to be something simple. That is why our Lord again clarifies that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You might recall back in Exodus chapter 5 that one of Pharaoh's chief complaints against Moses was, "Why do you make the people rest from their labors? I could be getting more out of them. I can optimize this situation and get higher efficiency, higher gains. What are you doing, Moses? You're messing up this thing that we've got." He said it as though this was something that would just undermine Moses' argument. Oh man, now I didn't even think about the fact that they're resting. The Lord's response here that he's showing in this story is, yes, precisely, they're resting. That's the point. That was my intent from the beginning. Thank you for calling that out, Pharaoh. You're absolutely correct. They're going to have rest from their labors, and your production numbers are going to go down a lot more than 1 in 7. Once again, the test here is not their diligence of work. They don't go out on the sixth day and, oh, I got to remember to get 2 omers. They just come back in and it just happens to be 2 omers. God has completely provided and paved the way for them. And yet, just like we all, some of them fail the test. Some of them, that Sabbath morning, they're back out ready to gather again. They need an instruction manual for how to take their vacation. It wasn't clear, apparently, when the Lord said that they should spend their day in rest. Instead, they're going to need a little bit more detail. It's interesting, too, that the Lord is angry with the people. Of course, you can imagine that Moses is probably angry with the people as well. And once again, the Lord communicates his anger with Moses. Verse 28, and the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws?" He's talking to them as effectively a covenant representative. Moses, why would you? Moses, it doesn't seem from the text that Moses was one of the ones who went out and tried to gather manna on the Sabbath morning. And yet he's speaking to Moses asking, why? Why won't you keep my laws? Moses still is that go-between, that intercessor between God and man throughout these. So much so that, remember, God told Moses, divide the Red Sea. I'll get right on that, Lord. Moses' actions are God's actions from the perspective of the people, and the people's actions are Moses' actions from the perspective of the Lord. That's how this seems to work. So the Lord provides a bit of an instruction manual for Sabbath. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. Just stay where you are. We talked about last week, this is a little bit like how you might speak to a toddler, where you've set up a boundary, and of course, as toddlers do, they've gone and crossed it. So now we're going to set a further back boundary. First it was, don't touch the hot stove. They touched the hot stove, we've been to the doctor and back. Now it's, don't come into the kitchen. We're going to go ahead and fence around this thing and make it a little bit harder for you to get to the disobedience. And the Lord does that for his people as a kind and loving parent who knows them, who knows their weaknesses. Let no one go out of his place. Notice this is not wrathful. He's angry with the people. They've disobeyed his word. They've failed his tests now a third time. And yet, this is not, you know what? You can't even rest when I tell you to rest. Forget it. I can find an easier people to work with. Surely who is it that we're going to read about here in a coming chapter? The Amalekites. Maybe I could work with them. It's not that kind of a response. It's okay. I'm your God. You're my people. We're gonna work through this. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be painful. But we can also see a little bit of the pattern of law here. This is a law that Israel is going to take very seriously in the future. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. According to historians, by Jesus' time, we're going to have strict limits on the number of steps you can go from your place. So they're taking that law very seriously. At the same time, they've now got a manual for reading the manual for their vacation. It's not restful. It's not the spirit. And so Jesus rightly challenges them on their Sabbath practices, saying, look, this is not what the Lord gave you. This is not what Moses gave you. This is something else altogether. You've missed the spirit of what was being said. As Andrew and Spencer are preaching through the Beatitudes over and over, the Lord is telling us, you've missed the spirit of what was being said. The point wasn't, you can do all the violence you want short of murder. That was not the commandment. The spirit of what was being said was to respect the image of God in one another. And that's a whole different thing, trying to please the Lord rather than trying to get as close to displeasing him as possible, but not quite crossing that line. Walking to the edge of your tent on the Sabbath, but not quite going over the threshold. The Lord is working with his people kindly, and yet we can misunderstand that. The rules that you give a toddler, probably not appropriate for your teenager. If you won't allow them into the kitchen because of the hot stove, we might have some parenting issues that we need to discuss on how to handle children as they mature and prepare them for adulthood. And so it is with Israel. We have one last section in chapter 16, verses 31 through 36.
Now the house of Israel called its name Manna. It was like coriander seed. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony. The people of Israel ate the manna 4 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And Omer is a tenth part.
Thank you. So we get this beautiful statement of the Lord's purpose in verse 32. If it was not clear the function of law in the life of an Israelite, we now have a new law. They are to take some of this and keep it throughout their generations, so that they may see the bread which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. They are not to see so that they can obey. The ultimate purpose of this structure is not their compliance with the Lord's instructions. They are to obey and take this manna and place it so that they can see. So that they can know that it was the Lord who cared for them. So that they can remember throughout their generations the role of obedience to the law was to empower that relationship, the ability to know God. If they had not obeyed, if they had said, nope, we know what's going to happen to that manna the day after we pick it up. We are not putting that in any sort of a special place to us. It's going to stink and smell bad. The consequence would be failure to see. And the ultimate problem that the Lord would be interacting with would be a failure to know the Lord. So we can see the Lord's priority here, as we have throughout. His intention with Pharaoh is that Pharaoh and the nations and the people will know that I am the Lord. And over again throughout his law, we get these statements of purposes. It is a purpose, singular more specifically. It is so that they may know that I am the Lord. The commandment is set throughout your generations. And in a sense, this is a commandment that we keep each week when we keep the Lord's Supper. We have a very visible reminder in front of all of us of the bread that came down from heaven, not just in the wilderness at Sinai, but to the people in Galilee and to us as well. There's an odd statement before the testimony. We get two sort of anachronisms in this passage. An anachronism, of course, is a little bit of a break in the story's chronology. It's out of chronological order. This is to be kept before the testimony. The testimony, as I understand it, is the Hebrew word for the Ark of the Covenant. A beautiful thing that is going to be created several books from now, but has not yet. Does not yet exist in the life of Israel. So a little bit of a break there. That's interesting that they would do that. Already pointing forward. The second break is verse 35 that speaks of 40 years in the wilderness. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years. We haven't even read why they're going to be in the wilderness 40 years. We know. The Israelites don't know at this part of the narrative, and you can almost imagine all of a sudden they look to the camera and they said, did you say 40 what? Like, who said anything? We're like halfway through and it's only been 3 months. Just keep going. Forget the 40 years problem. These stories seem to be meant to be read with the end in mind. It's as though by the time you're old enough to read it, you already should know the story so well from your parents and your grandparents that you know where it's going. It's not a surprise that they're going to be around for 40 years. It's not a surprise that the Lord will have them build an ark of testimony to help them to remember and see that he is the Lord. These things are all known from the beginning. And so these anachronisms get sprinkled in throughout. That closes chapter 16 for us. Any questions or comments before we move on?
I was wondering.
Yeah, Jenny.
What you were just saying about it being meant for later generations, this particular portion, is it possible that Moses was writing this after the testimony had already been put together and they already knew they were going to be in the desert or in the wilderness for 40 years?
I think that's very probable. Okay. Moses is looking back on the events and writing the history. He's breaking the timeline of the narrative. I don't mean to say that this was necessarily either divine prophecy, the Lord warns Moses that he's going to be there for 40 years, or a later editor. I don't think that either of those are necessary explanations as we come here. All right, let's look to chapter 17, reading D, verses 1 through 7.
Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel. and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?"
Thank you. So remember that each time that the Lord has provided for Israel so far along the way, he's warned them that a test comes along with that provision. We've read that three times now. First with the bitter water made sweet, then with the manna that they're not to gather, not to save any over to the next day, then the manna again that they're not to gather on the seventh day. He's telling them, I'm providing for you, but you didn't trust me, and I'm going to give you another opportunity to trust me. There's another test baked into this. Here, in verse, where are we? Verse 2, we read, Moses says to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" The Lord is testing Israel's faith and faithfulness, and yet Israel is testing the Lord's patience. Over and over and over again, they're actually blaspheming against the Lord in some of their first interactions in the wilderness. The Lord brought us out here to die. Or Moses brought us out here. Even better, we're going to attribute the Lord's actions to a human being and then attribute evil to that person. So it's just heaping insult on top of insult. The Lord's testing was for Israel's good. Israel's testing of the Lord was a mess and caused deep, deep problems for them. Moses is told to pass on before the people. It's a bit of an odd phrase. It's a bit hard to reconstruct specifically what it meant, whether he would be up high. The point seems to be everyone should take notice of this. You've got, we've said, 3 to 6 million people in the wilderness. There's going to be a lot that happens in Moses' life that is not necessarily visible to most of the congregation of Israel. But this thing, it's important that they take notice of. This thing they should pause and see what's about to happen. As the Lord brings water from the rock for them that is stricken by the staff of Moses. Of course, the Apostle Paul will find great significance in this, reminding us that the rock was stricken as Christ is stricken. That as we don't just have bread at the Lord's table, we have bread and wine. So manna and water were provided for Israel throughout their time in the wilderness. The place is named very similar to what we read in chapter 16. Let's see. The first name that we got was Marah, meaning bitterness for the well that they drank from and the bitterness of the people. This place is named Massah and Meribah, which mean testing and quarreling. That word for quarreling can also be translated rebellion. And that seems to be sort of the sense of the word. They're not just arguing. They're in full-on rebellion against the Lord and against Moses. They're ready to kill Moses because of the lack of water in this place. We have to remember that as they're so frustrated, as they're so angry with Moses, ready to kill him, they're eating manna cakes. The bread just fell from heaven this morning, or yesterday morning, if they happen to be ready to kill him on a Sabbath, which would be especially bad. And while they're chewing on this bread from heaven, miraculously provided, they have lost any confidence in the Lord's ability to provide water. There's no bitter wells around them. What could God do now? So much so that they're ready to kill Moses. And their question, perhaps worse than even the blasphemy attributing evil to the intent of the Lord and bringing them to the wilderness, is the summary at the end of verse 7. Is the Lord among us or not? I think reading E is Exodus chapter 3, verse 12. Could someone read that for me?
I'm sorry, what verse?
Exodus chapter 3, verse 12 is reading E.
Oh, I have it. So he said, "Certainly be with you. This shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. You have brought the people out of Egypt. You shall serve God on this mountain."
Thank you. So when Moses doubted whether the Lord should be sending him and whether the people would believe him. The sign given to Moses, which he wrote down in the Pentateuch, seems reasonable that he has shared with Israel. The sign was that they would come back to the Mount Horeb that he had been on when he saw the burning bush to serve the Lord. The Lord has fulfilled his promise. As unlikely as it seems, he sent Moses all the way back into Egypt, the fugitive murderer, to go and take out 6 million slaves right out from under the most powerful man in the world, who died like sniffing out a candle, and then they were fed and watered in the desert as they went, 6 million of them, at least a month's journey to get to Sinai. And they have the gall to ask, is the Lord among us or not? Really? Like, okay, sure, you kept that sign. But what now? The sign is over. Maybe you're done with us. They're doubting over and over and over again whether the Lord is on their side. And it really strikes at that question, that statement that he's made, I shall be your God and you shall be my people. They're asking, really? Because it's been 2 days since I've had anything to drink. And so maybe the Egyptian gods the pantheon maybe had a few gods that could take care of the water problem for us a little bit better than you could, Lord. It's, again, we can empathize with it and feel it. I don't know what it's like to not have had water for 2 days, thankfully. And yet we can also look at it and just see our own faithlessness in the face of adversity. All right, now the story changes gears quite a bit. So we've sort of finished the testing section, and as we do, I'll ask, are there questions or comments as we move on? Yeah, Aaron.
I'm just kind of wrestling with that in my brain a little bit. It seems like that's a pretty big thing to reflect on a little bit, that in spite of the fact that he's taking them through one of the greatest salvation stories in history, and in spite of the fact that they are eating this miraculous food in the middle of a kind of barren wasteland, they're still grumbling at God, and yet he still provides and all that kind of stuff. I guess, is this passage intended to reflect on yourself in this? I know sometimes narrative, you have to be careful about thinking of it too much as parable, but just to reflect on the fact that when there is hardship in your life or things that are painful that you're going through, make sure you're not so focused on on the pain, and to reflect on his thought. I'm kind of curious, did the commentators say anything?
Well, so that's a really complex question. And it really, I love it. It gets right at the heart of what is the meaning? What is the purpose? Moses, why did you write this down? What am I supposed to take here? There are some schools of thought. Well, so we're a Protestant church. We're part of the Reformation tradition. And of course, before the Protestant Reformation, or like immediately before, much of church tradition was to take this almost entirely allegorically. Not as though to say that it wasn't historically true, but that any sort of historical veracity had nothing to do with the narrative itself. Every other sentence was a picture of Jesus or of Mary or of some other New Testament concept. Amalek that we're about to read attacking Israel probably represented some particular sin and temptation that we experience in life, and the lifting up of hands represented how we're supposed to respond to it. It did not. I'll say that tradition did not respect the text, because the text doesn't say that. Some Reformed traditions have gone, particularly in the 19th century, Schleiermacher and others in Germany would go so far as to say that the history is the meaning. The fact that these things happened really in history is the point of the text. This is a history book. You want to read. These are the things that happened a long time ago. And there's the meaning. This happened. I don't think that respects the text particularly well either. There's so much that happened that Moses didn't write down. And so often as he writes, he breaks from the narrative, from the particular history, and says, this is why we do this to this day. This is why we don't eat the sinew of the hip to this day, with Jacob's wrestling with the Lord. In the poems, he's constantly breaking, saying, I wait for your salvation, O Lord. I think both of those are sort of extremes. Where I look for sort of a little bit of a more moderate approach and hopefully more solid ground than just this is the hermeneutic that I like would actually be to the book of Hebrews. The author warns the people, I don't know that I can quote this from memory, do not test the Lord as they did at Meribah. There is certainly something exemplary for us, an admonition and a warning. More than that, I think there's also an indication of who we are as a people and what we're like. As the Lord's people, we have incredibly high moral standards, and that's a lovely thing that we ought to continue. The law is beautiful. And yet, our expectation of our own personal holiness ought not to be particularly lofty. We ought to recognize that we're sheep. That a few days with no water and we've forgotten who God is entirely. So that's how I try to divide that. Does that address?
Yeah, it seems like a pretty sobering warning just to watch your own heart and wait on the Lord instead of grumbling and complaining.
Yeah. One of the most interesting questions that we will not get to in this class is the use of the word law in the New Testament. It's used all over the place, sometimes Paul talks about how the law kills, other times how he talks about how it is holy and righteous and good, and good if one uses it lawfully. The Lord, of course, says not one jot or tittle shall pass away. It's interesting to ask what is meant by that word law. Of course, Israel used the word Torah to describe the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And so when we talk about the law being a mirror, something that I've found in this course is it's not just the rules that are a mirror, but rather the narrative itself tells me so much about who I am and what I'm like. Things that laws themselves, rules, I might be able to wiggle the way that Israel did and say, well, I've technically not murdered anyone. See how I have officially kept this law and how godlike I am, or godly I am. The narrative sort of tears down that possibility for me and says, well, you know, the letter really was never the point. So hopefully you all have found that too. As we've walked through this narrative, both encouragement that the Lord is faithful when we are repeatedly not, but also sort of a tempering of our own sense of our personal holiness as we go through this wilderness journey together. All right, let's look to the battle with Amalek. Let's see, this is reading F, verses 8 through 16.
Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. And they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Thank you. So this is, in our narrative thus far, this is the second instance of what we would call a righteous war against Gentiles. The first occurred as Abraham rescued Lot in Genesis chapter 14. We're going to see some more parallels there. We did see one instance of unrighteous war, of course, as Jacob's sons overthrew the town of Shechem. But with the account going how it does, it's hard to even call that a war. It's more of a slaughter. And so there's not particular parallels there. As Moses holds up his hands, the battle goes in Israel's favor. And of course, he has the staff of Aaron in his hand. As he does for all of the miracles, by the way, almost all of them involve lifting the staff or striking something with the staff or throwing the staff. And as they lower, as Moses tires, the people's fortunes in battle wane. God's giving them super clear pictures. If you thought that maybe coincidentally the Red Sea split as you walked up to it, let me show you. When you rely on me, you have everything you need. Nothing can come against you. Nothing can withstand you. When you don't rely on me, when you grow weary of your reliance, you're on your own, and you haven't got a lot to offer. Over and over and over again, he's tying back their success to his being their God and their being his people. And here is just another picture of that. As Moses grows weary and his arms fall, we get this picture of Aaron and Hur holding them up. It's almost comical. Like you could think of a children's cartoon, you know, that as things lower, things change elsewhere. God's going to great lengths to illustrate this picture to Israel. They've not gotten it so far, and he's made some really great pictures so far. So he's laying it on thick, making it extremely obvious that his success is their success. And we get this passage at the end, verses 15 and 16. If you're reading from different translations, you likely don't think you're even reading the same verse, because each translation has a very unique take on this particular verse. It's difficult to translate. Jehovah Nissi is the name which means the banner of the Lord. And the explanation is a hand upon the banner of Yah, it seems, or maybe upon the throne of Yah. The banner could indicate the staff that Moses was lifting. It's a little bit hard for us to read too much into that. What we can agree on, regardless of the translations that you're working with or the particular ways to parse the Hebrew, what we can agree on is that this is all about trusting the Lord, reliance on him. And it's an encouragement to Israel not to tire in that reliance. They are so fickle. They're so quick to worship him and to join in the song of Moses and then to turn right around and grumble and rebel because of the bitter water. So don't grow weary. Be steadfast in your reliance on the Lord. Trust him. Hang in there. It's a very comforting, encouraging moment for Israel. And of course, it introduces Joshua as Moses' replacement. We don't have much to say about chapter 18, but I would like for us to read it. Readings G and H, please. Oh, yes, there was a question.
Well, it's more a comment on 17 as well. It's telling you to rely on God, and it's a picture of that. I think it's also a picture of we are going to grow weary, and we need those around us to help us lift our eyes when we can't on our own.
Yeah, that seems very reasonable. All right, could we start with chapter 18?
Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her home, along with her two sons. The name of the one is Gershon, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the name of the other, Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he encamped at the mountain of God. And when he sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel, in that he had delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Jethro said, "Blessed be the God Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people." And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God.
Thank you. And now we can go directly to reading H, verses 13 forward.
"And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from the morning until the evening. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, 'What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning until evening?' And Moses said to his father-in-law, 'Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor, and make known the statutes of God and his laws.' And Moses' father-in-law said to him, 'The thing that you are doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk, and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place them, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens, and let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace.' So Moses listened to his father-in-law, and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel, and made them heads over the peoples, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And they judged the people at all times. The difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but the minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way in his own land."
Thank you. So Jethro is introduced in verse 1 as a priest of Midian, without much explanation. Midian is not Israel, and so it's reasonable to ask, is this a priest of the Lord or of some pagan religion? The context really doesn't give it to us clearly, at least not at verse 1. By verse 10, however, we read this beautiful blessing that the priest of Midian pronounces on Moses, the covenant head of Israel. And he has this particular statement in verse 11. "Now I know that the Lord..." Remember back in chapter 9, verse 16, as we talked about the different audiences for the Lord's work with Pharaoh, he gave these purpose statements, usually associated with, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that..." Sometimes it was so that Pharaoh would know, that Egypt would know, that Israel would know. Implicit, it seemed like sometimes that Moses would know. In 9:16, we read that "my name may be known in all the earth." Here we have this Gentile priest reciting the wondrous deeds of the Lord. The Lord's name is being known by nations far outside of Israel, and the renown of the Exodus seems to almost have gone before them. Not gone before them. We do read of Moses explaining it to him in verses 1 through 10. So that's really profound. We're seeing that intent of the Lord's being fulfilled already. We don't think of the Pentateuch typically as a text that is evangelistic towards Gentile nations. We certainly will read of war with Gentile nations towards the close of the book especially. We've read of war with Gentile nations just in the previous chapter, but this chapter seems to serve almost as an offset. Some of the nations know the Lord as they are subjected to his people and lose in battle. Other nations come to know the Lord affectionately and in a positive way. We've heard a story very much like this in the past, and we've already looked briefly back, but it involved victory in war against Gentiles, followed by a Gentile priest showing up who blesses God and the covenant head. It's usually immediately followed by the cutting of a covenant. Of course, we're talking about Genesis chapter 14 and Melchizedek as he showed up on the scene, as Hebrews says, without father or mother, not necessarily because he didn't have a father or mother, but there's no lineage given to him. It's not explained where he came from. He's not part of God's people. He's not part of Israel. He shows up. He blesses Abraham. And a covenant is cut in chapter 15. Remember, that's the smoking pot, the flaming torch, probably the pinnacle of all of the expressions of covenant to Abraham. So also here, our Gentile priest shows up, pronounces blessing, and as we turn in 3 months to chapter 19, a covenant is cut, just as we expected. The blessing that Melchizedek pronounces on Abraham focuses on the Abrahamic covenant as a continuation of creation work. Remember, it was blessed be the God of Abraham, creator of heaven and earth. He's tying it all the way back to Genesis 1. In Jethro's blessing on Moses, he's focusing on this covenant that's coming up in chapter 19, not as a continuation of creation, but rather as a continuation of the Exodus, of redemption. We read again in verse 10, "Blessed be the Lord who has delivered you, deliverance, out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." This is Moses' way of tying what's about to happen, this covenant of law, to deliverance for the people. Another word for that is redemption. The last comment I have on this chapter before we close is a bit of an orphan comment. It doesn't go with the flow at all. But verse 19, he gives Moses advice about how to set up a hierarchical government for Israel so that each dispute is not immediately settled by Moses. You can imagine the disputes that must arise from 3 to 6 million grumpy people in the wilderness. There would have been a lot for Moses to do. This passage is one that we still refer back to as justification for the Presbyterian form of government. I had the privilege of participating in our Presbytery meeting just 2 weeks ago in Alaska, and there are ruling elders and teaching elders from all over the Pacific Northwest who come together, and anything that was too difficult for one church to decide is decided at the Presbytery level. And if it's too difficult for the Presbytery to decide, we have a national gathering. Other Presbyterian denominations have another hierarchy level in between called a synod. It's not that this is necessarily prescriptive. Moses doesn't step out and say, and this is how all governments shall operate henceforth. But it's wise. We recognize that the point of this text, as Jethro comes, what Moses is laying out, is this Gentile priest had some serious wisdom to offer Moses and to make his life easier. That it was a blessing to Moses to receive this wisdom and to adopt it. While the guidance of the Lord and the laws given by the Lord, as we get to chapter 19 and further, are a blessing on Israel, there's also the blessing of worldly wisdom, just a practicality, which is good because so far everything we've read about practicality in this passage has been negative. The practical Israelites gathering too much manna or gathering on the wrong day or counting how much water is left and panicking has always been this negative thing. Here we have a little bit of a counterbalance, that there is worldly wisdom that is valuable and wise and that does not lead us to doubt that he is our God and that we are his people. We have 2 more weeks, and I hope that we're able to spend them reflecting on where we've come in the Pentateuch thus far and getting a little bit of a hint of what is to come in the chapters ahead. Again, It's a bit of an awkward place to end. The point of the class has been that the narratives and the legal matter are one piece cut from the same cloth, and yet we're going to deal with them in separate years. My apologies for where that division landed. Not intentional. Please don't take it to imply anything about the nature of the text. Take it to imply everything about the nature of my ability to plan. There you go.
Shot JR, part one.
Join us next season. Same time, same channel. All right, with that, let's close in prayer. Father God, you have made us your people, and you have provided for us miraculously the forgiveness that we could never, ever hope to have accomplished or acquired has been granted to us just by being yours. We thank you for that forgiveness and pray that you would teach us to trust it, not to always be measuring our personal holiness against the law of perfection, but rather to be endeavoring to live the law to please you, knowing that you love us, that you are ours, that you are here to bless us and not to curse, that you have brought us into this wilderness for your own good purpose, and that it will be our joy to watch that unfold. In Jesus' name, amen.